I'm always tempted just to say, are we having fun yet? Well, I hope we are. I hope we're enjoying this study. We've talked about science versus evolution. We've talked about the age of the earth, what the Bible and science say really about the age of the earth and the universe. So we're going to talk now about science of the Bible versus theistic evolution. Why not theistic evolution? This may surprise you. My son Reagan, who is an orthodontist, he told me a number of years ago, he says, do you know the number one reason to be against theistic evolution? People get into theistic evolution trying to justify science with the Bible. But Dad, number one reason that theistic evolution is wrong, it's just scientifically wrong. It doesn't matter if it's atheist or theist. In the evolutionary beginning, it's just wrong. And so I've got to tell you a few more things about what science says about evolution. I believe I took this picture at the Houston Museum of Natural History. Some of you may recognize it. Evolutionists tell us that dinosaurs evolved and became extinct 70 million years before man evolved. The Bible says man and the animals were created on the last 2 days of creation. This would have men coexisting with dinosaurs, wouldn't it? It certainly would. You look at Job chapter 40, verses 15 through 24, and it talks about Behemoth and Leviathan, and you see creatures there that very likely were dinosaurs. In fact, when it talks about the one, it says he has a tail as big as a cedar, and that when the Jordan River is flooding, he just raises his head up. I think of a Gigantosaurus, big enough for flooding waters not to disturb his location, to just raise his head up and breathe and not worry about how the flood is. And you got people down here know what floods are like and how floods are so destructive. And yet, the book of Job talks about an animal that was huge and didn't allow that to be a problem. There's more evidence that man and dinosaurs most likely coexisted. When you look at this obvious man-made hammer, an iron portion of the hammer with a wooden shaft, and you realize it's enclosed with rock that has fossils, and the fossils are dated back to about 140 million years ago when the dinosaurs were living. That would say if man made this, and these fossils date back to the time of the dinosaurs, man and dinosaurs coexisted. And then you see fossils like this, not a barefoot human print, but a shoe. And in this, what looks very obviously to be trilobite fossils that date back to about 300 to 400 million years ago. And then you go, well, if you're just looking at the data, does that mean that man lived before the dinosaurs evolved? You know, if you're going to think evolutionary way of thinking, you'd have to ask that question, wouldn't you? Well, here's a life form obviously coexisting with human beings. What about the evolutionary horse series? You know, you just can't look at a book on evolution or at a book on horses and not see the evolutionary horse series. And so these horses, they tell the story how they evolved from the little horse all the way up to the modern day horse. And yet what you need to understand, the truth is this horse series was created out of imagination. George Gaylord Simpson, world-renowned Harvard professor, stated the uniform continuous transformation of the Hyracotherium, that's the little bitty horse, into Equus, so dear to the hearts of generations of textbook writers, never occurred in nature. So when you see them put this in the textbooks, you realize it just is not true. Bruce McFadden, the Florida Museum of Natural History, said, over the years, fossil horses have been cited as a prime example of orthogenesis, straight line evolution. It can no longer be considered a valid theory. We find that once a notion becomes part of accepted scientific knowledge, it's very difficult to modify or reject it. So he says the orthogenesis, the straight line evolution of horses, that just didn't happen. But what is more important, I think, even than that statement is the last part of this statement. I want you to focus in on this when he says we find that once a notion becomes part of accepted scientific knowledge, it is very difficult to modify or reject it. No matter what the data says, no matter what the facts are, once they get it in the textbooks, they just like to keep on telling the story. Kind of like last night when we talked about the Biston petularia, you know, the pepper moth. They know it's not true. They know it doesn't prove anything. If the story was true, it still didn't prove anything but demographic changes. But they just like the story so much. It's kind of like an after-dinner speaker. He's got his favorite stories. They just got to keep on telling them. But the problem with this is they're teaching people how they think the world came into existence. Colin Patterson, British Museum of Natural History, said there have been an awful lot of stories, some more imaginative than others. The most famous example, still on exhibit downstairs, you know, in his museum, is the exhibit of horse evolution prepared perhaps 50 years ago. This has been presented as literal truth in textbook after textbook. He said 50 years ago we prepared this display of horse evolution. And it came out of imagination, not out of science, not out of data, not out of facts, not out of the geology and the fossils. Imagination. Now I want you to notice the date. 1984. So you're thinking, wait a second, the guy that's a curator for this museum, he's saying this is imagination, it's been there for 50 years. And you're thinking when you go to London in 2013, there's no way it's still going to be there because these guys have got to be honest. So I showed you last night how when we walked in the museum, what it looked like, and the human display of what they say is how we evolved. Well, sure enough, yeah, it's still there, or at least it was in 2013. Horse evolution, display in the British Museum of Natural History, 50 million years ago, showing the little horse. And then, much later, 2 million years, showing the modern-day horse. I know it's hard to see because that room was so dark, I had a hard time getting a good picture, and it's behind glass. So now you got a problem with the glass reflecting any light that you would use. But it's there. And they know it's not true. They just like the story, so they keep teaching it. So you look at this biology textbook that has been used for honors biology students in Texas high schools. Now, what you need to also understand is Texas is such a big state. We're up to, I think, 30, 32 million people now. But even before we were up that much, we were at the 20 million. It's such a big state compared to so many other states. In fact, one of my best friends was on the State Board of Education, Dr. Jay Johnson. And I was going to talk to Jay about this when this came back up, but he cycled off before they were looking at these textbooks again. And here's the deal. Other states, instead of doing the research, Jay would read all these books. He was really doing his due diligence in all the textbooks. So Oklahoma, Colorado, a lot of these states, and I'm just throwing these states out as an example, they just take whatever Texas is going to use, and they use it too. So this is not limited to Texas. So you look at these books, and what do you see? Horse evolution. Well, this book is a little older, so I went and got the new book. Borrowed it from our high school, one of the teachers there. It's over the biology department. And sure enough, still teaching this horse evolution and the more modern books that we're teaching our high school students. You see, once you get to teaching a theory, a story, you just like telling it. It's like you don't want to learn something new. And what it really is science fiction. Well, what about evolution's biogenetic law that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. You like that terminology? Let me tell you what it means. This was coined by Ernst Haeckel back in 1866 to describe the fraudulent theory that embryonic development recapitulates through all the adult stages in the embryo of all these forms you evolved from. And so Haeckel showed, and Haeckel was a German embryologist and medical doctor. Now, you didn't have cameras that would look through your microscopes like we do today, so he drew these. He was also a very accomplished artist. And he's saying, you see the similarity with these embryos and how, you know, we just start off at a single cell beginning at fertilization. We start coming through, and then we're in the fish stage, and then we come into all our own stages, and this is just proof of evolution. I want to tell you right now, if evolution's true, I kind of think this ought to be true. But you need to know right now, this is a fraud. Haeckel perpetuated a fraud. These drawings are a fraud. He was not seeing this in the microscope. This was a fraud. When I went to Stephen F. Austin State University, they would not allow you, if you were pre-med or pre-dental, to take human anatomy and physiology. Can you imagine that? You're pre-med, you're pre-dental. I thought maybe all universities like that. That's really why I became to resent the biology department at Stephen F. Austin. When I went to the University of Texas, I'm taking human gross anatomy, and all my classmates who had gone to other universities were able to study human anatomy ahead of time. Oh, and our pre-professional advisor would tell us, if you take human anatomy and physiology instead of comparative anatomy, I won't give you a recommendation to get into medical or dental school. Now, I have been a professor of anatomy and physiology, and I realize there is no value, really, if you're going to go and be a physician or a dentist in the human body, of studying comparative anatomy, but it was crammed down my throat. Since I left Stephen F. Austin, it's even gotten more deeply into teaching evolution. And I resent it because it was of no value going to dental school. It made gross anatomy all that much more challenging. Because you see, when we teach anatomy and physiology, we teach a systems approach. And so when you're in high school and you're in college, taking anatomy and physiology is the way to learn it. It's the easier way to learn the anatomy. But you get to medical school and dental school, then you don't learn systems approach, you learn surgical approach. And I tell you what, it is a lot more difficult, but it's the whole idea of being a surgeon. You take your knife and you start at a certain area, maybe in a shoulder, maybe in the mouth. What are you going to pierce as you go through that? You don't want to start cutting nerves and arteries and things you don't intend to cut. And so you've got to know every area, every layer, very complicated, very difficult. And it's easier if you've already got the human anatomy and physiology systems approach first. But no, it's not Stephen F. Austin. It's not other universities as well. And I know the reason, at least I'm confident of the reason of why they cram the comparative anatomy down your throat, is because sometimes when young ladies go to an abortion clinic and they're concerned and their conscience is bothering them whether they should have an abortion or not, and the abortion doctors sometimes are known to say, well, you need to understand that this embryo inside you is still in the fish stage. Well, if it's just a fish, that, you know, we go up to Sam Rayburn Lake and pull crappie out all the time, right? Not a problem. You know, if you didn't eat it, when you wasted it, well, that's not the best thing, but what's it been hurt? And so you pull an embryo out of a woman, it's just a fish, so to speak, because it's in the fish stage. Yeah, a preaching brother of mine, he heard me lecture on this one time, and he said, you know, if they're so proud of this, they ought to do what they do with prize bass. You catch an 8-10 pound bass, sometimes you have it mounted and you have it up on the wall, right? When are they going to start taking these embryos and mounting them and put them up on the wall so people can walk into your home and see what you're proud of having destroyed? I think that's the reason they cram comparative anatomy down our throats. Because we might be in a profession giving people advice. So I will just tell you, if you've not watched the movie Silent Spring, you really ought to. When I taught anatomy and physiology in the second semester when we were on reproduction, I showed that video every semester to my students. Many of my students, if not almost all of them, were pre-professional, like pre-nursing, pre-x-ray technician, this sort of thing. Some of them were pre-dental hygiene. And I said, you know, you may be getting a situation where they're asking you to assist in abortions. Now, I have a son-in-law that's an OBGYN, and the other two physicians in their group delivering babies refuse. We are not doing abortions in this hospital. It will not be allowed. Because they all have the values that are taught in the Bible. But I'd tell them, I said, listen, you may be asked to do these, and you don't have to say yes. And you need to make your mind up now what you believe on this. And when you watch the movie Silent Spring, when they create an abortion on video, well, I tell you what, it'll teach you what it's all about. Well, Haeckel drew these embryos. And they're still in the textbooks today. High school textbooks. College textbooks. A man became my son Justin's father-in-law, Dr. Paul Douthit. I was in his home. We were talking about this. I'd preached on it the night before, and he's feeding us lunch. And he says, you know, when I was in college, that wasn't taught. I said, yeah, it was in your textbooks. Maybe God bless your professor for not, you know, getting in and trying to cram it down your throat like it's done me. He said, no, I don't think it's in there. I said, well, isn't that your library over there? Paul, you got to know him. He's real quiet. He goes over there, picks up the book, starts looking through it, and he goes, yeah, it's here, just like you said. I said, well, it's good that your professor didn't try to cram it down your throat. He didn't even expose you to it. So, I was taught this theory every Monday and Wednesday throughout that semester. You see, what you need to know, the truth is, Haeckel redesigned the middle stages, not the beginning stages, but the middle stages of these embryos and label them as the first stage. So here's what he did. You see in this middle row, that's what the embryos really looked like. The top row is how he redesigned them when he drew the pictures. And you see we all just start out in this very elementary fish stage and we end up in the particular animals that we became. Notice what this quotation is from the Montague-Gish-Princeton debate. It says, and the theory of recapitulation was destroyed in 1921, that's over 100 years ago, by Professor Walter Garstang in a famous paper. Since then, no respectable biologist has ever used the theory of recapitulation because it was utterly unsound, created by a Nazi-like preacher named Haeckel. So, since then, if you've been teaching this, you're not a respectable biologist. Well, that takes in a whole lot of folks. I agree with that statement 100%. Keith Thompson, the president of the Academy of Natural Sciences, said, surely the biogenetic law is as dead as a doornail. It was finally exorcised from biology textbooks in the 50s. That's the 1950s. As a topic of serious theoretical inquiry, it was extinct in the 20s. Just like we saw in the previous quote. Oh, was it really? You go to these textbooks and you see they're still being taught because once they find a story, they just like to keep on teaching the story. And so here's the most modern textbook we're teaching in Texas now, still teaching this theory that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. And what it really is, it's science fiction. It's not the truth. They show the geologic time scale and talk about these index fossils that they use to date these particular levels of the column. You need to understand there's a lot of problems with this geologic column, and we're going to expose some of them. It's supposed to represent the evolutionary tree. that life began, as you see at the very bottom of the screen, the single cell beginning. And from that single cell beginning, that all the plants, all the animals, and human beings all evolved from that single cell beginning. And what you need to know is this problem that they have is you don't see this in the data. It's just not in the fossil record. It's out of imagination. They made it up. They tell the story. I look at young people like you guys. Here you are toward the front of the building and you're taking notes and paying attention. You're awesome. You guys have brains and you're thinking. Let me tell you what they're trying to do. They're trying to play you for a dummy. And there are a lot of dummies out there that get tricked. Don't be a dummy. Be smart. Think with your brain. Ask questions. If you don't ask the teacher or the professor, at least ask yourself, does this make any sense at all? And you can see how it doesn't. They're trying to fool you. Stephen Jay Gould, Ph.D., Harvard University, said the evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data only at the tips and the nodes of their branches. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. So he says when you see this biologic tree, that didn't come from fossils. All we have evidence for is out here on the tips of the branches. You see a horse. You see a cow. You see a cougar. That's what you've got. But is there any evolutionary fossil evidence? No, not at all. Colin Patterson said, I fully agree with your comments on the lack of evolutionary transition in my book. He said, if there were any, I would have included them. He said, when he wrote a book on paleontology, that's his field of expertise, being a PhD, he said, I couldn't put any fossil evidence in there of these transitional forms because there isn't any. David Robson, the years after Darwin, his advocates hoped to find predictable progressions. In general, they have not been found. Yet the optimism has died hard and some pure fantasy has crept into the textbooks. Dodd and Batten said, we have arranged the groups in a traditional way, with the simplest forms first, progressively more complex forms following. This particular arrangement is arbitrary. In other words, we just made it up and depends upon what definition of complexity you wish to choose. When he's talking about a definition of complexity, what's he talking about? We think of the human eye and how wonderful it is, and yes, it is wonderful. But it's maybe not the most complex eye in the universe. Some scientists say the eyes that the trilobites had seem to be maybe even more complex than what we use. So it's how you define complexity. W. Swinton, the British Museum of Natural History, said the evolutionary origin of the bird is largely a matter of deduction. There's no fossil evidence. No fossil evidence of the stages through which the remarkable change from reptile to bird was achieved. There's no fossil evidence for that. So here's the second problem with this evolutionary tree. It's the actual content in these layers, the geologic column. Now, if you're in school, it might make you memorize the names of all these layers. I'm not going to do that. But what I do want you to see is up there on the bottom left-hand corner of this chart, you're going to see a red circle. And around that circle is the Cambrian, and below that's the Precambrian. And that's supposed to be where life just starts getting fossilized and life is supposedly beginning. So you need to understand that this lowest area is supposed to have the most elementary life forms. And the Cambrian layer is now talked about it as an explosion layer. The Cambrian period, the explosion of life. Richard Dawkins, boy, he hates creation, anti-creationist. He said, and we find many of them already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. It is as though they were planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted creationists. So you go to his book, The Blind Watchmaker, and what you see is him saying, when you look at the fossil record, what do you see? You see what a creationist would expect to see. You see? Yeah. And that's an evolutionist saying that. Richard Monastirsky said the remarkably complex forms of animals we see today suddenly appear. This moment, right at the start of the Earth's Cambrian period, marks the evolutionary explosion that filled the seas with the Earth's first complex creatures. This is Genesis material, gushed one researcher. Stephen Gould again said the Cambrian explosion occurred in a geologic moment. We have reason to believe that all major anatomical designs may have made their evolutionary appearance at that time. All the major anatomical designs starting at the Cambrian, you know, the very earliest. Not only the phylum chordata itself, but all its major divisions. Now, you and I, as human beings, are classified by biologists as being in this phylum chordata. But he says all the major divisions are there as well. Since the so-called Cambrian explosion, no new phyla of animals have entered into the fossil record. So you can go down to the very bottom of this fossil record, and all these major life forms are found there. The large animal phyla of today were present already in the early Cambrian, and that they were distinct from each other as they are today. So you see these life forms, all the major life forms, starting at the very beginning of the geologic column. Here's the third problem. It's the process of fossilization itself. When you see a fossil, you necessarily do see evidence of rapid catastrophe. And Dunbar Rogers, on the principle of stratigraphy, they said to some thoughtful stratigraphers, this amazing discovery, billions of years, presented a dilemma. For if the known stratified rocks had been accumulating through this vast span of time, the average rate of depositions must have been extremely slow. Yet there's very good evidence that the individual beds accumulated rapidly. When you look at fossils, how do you know a rapid situation? Well, look at a shrimp. It's a shrimp country. We had shrimp last night. I don't think I told anybody ahead of time. My wife loves shrimp. And sometimes her dad would bring back a big can full of shrimp. She grew up in Baytown. And, you know, they would devein and boil. And sometimes they would miss a shrimp and it'd be laying out on the counter. And you go back a few hours later, you think it's ready to cook and eat. Man, they decompose in a hurry. So when you see a fossil shrimp, what you see is a rapid catastrophe, covered it up, pressurized it, preserved it very, very quickly. Now, that could be a number of different ways, but I think the worldwide flood explains so much of the fossils that we have. When the Lord destroyed the world with a worldwide flood and the waters came in, all sorts of sediment would be formed in a very quick hurry. I was telling someone a little bit earlier, about almost, not quite, 3 years ago, I took my oldest grandson down to the Grand Canyon. And we traveled down the Grand Canyon for 3 days. We took a helicopter, went down into the bottom of the canyon. We got on J-rig boats, and we were going down the canyon for 3 days. Dr. Tim Cleary, a PhD geologist with the Institute for Creation Research, was with us, and he was explaining all these sedimentary layers. Dr. Cleary originally worked for an oil company, I believe it's Chevron, all over the world. And he's doing research now. And what he's finding is the same layers, like we're seeing in the Grand Canyon, are all over the world. Really speaks to the worldwide flood. So for 3 days, we're with Dr. Cleary. We're looking at all these sedimentary layers. And he's explaining how this is laid down most likely from the worldwide flood. So when you see a fossilized shrimp, you know rapid catastrophe. What about a fern? When I was a kid, we left Texas, went up to Oregon for 4 years. The first house we lived in was right across from this stand of Douglas fir trees. We used to call it the forest. And in under those trees, there were ferns. And I just thought they were so cool. And I would cut one off, bring it home, and my mom would put it in a vase of water. It didn't matter if it was in water. 2 hours later, you know what the fronds of that fern would do? They would have curled up. You're looking at a fossil fern. It's a fresh fern. No time for it to curl up. It would just take a matter of hours for the fronds to curl up. Yet something came in, maybe due to a worldwide flood, maybe a localized flood, and just covered it up, pressurized it, fossilized it pretty quickly. These fossils are so common, you can go to fossil stores, and not for a lot of money. I have some. And you can buy these fossilized fish. What's really cool about some of these fish, you notice that middle one? How it's eating a fish? Well, let's show you a different one. It's even more obvious. These fish were caught in the process of swallowing another fish and fossilized. You see the details of these fish in the fossilized form. This is an example of rapid catastrophe. You have to have some sort of rapid catastrophe for fossils to form. A number of years ago, when my kids were little, I went with the preschool class to the museum there at West Texas, what's called West Texas A&M now. And they were having dinosaur days. And there was this student, and I believe she was a graduate student. She was wearing a white coat, and she's talking to the kids about what paleontologists do. And she said, you know, here's this big sandbox, and she has some cattle bones covered up with sand. And she said, a paleontologist goes digging through the different layers, and they'll find a bone. And they said, now, these are cattle bones, but this illustrates what we're talking about with these dinosaur bones. So a dinosaur back in the day would die, and it would be there for thousands of years. And slowly but surely, this dirt would come in and cover it up, and it would fossilize it. And now we look for these fossils. Now, I didn't do this, but it was all I could do to keep from doing that. I remember stepping back about a step and thinking to myself, there's not a cowboy in West Texas dumb enough to believe that story. I grew up my teenage years and then moved back after dental school because I love the Panhandle. And a lot of my friends are ranchers and farmers. If I'd tell my friend Dan that he ought to just leave his cattle when they die out there in the pasture because, you know, they'll eventually be taken care of. Well, I'll tell you what, a lot faster than that story was. Because you see, you let your cow die, what happens? Does he stay there for a few thousand years and become a fossil? No, that doesn't happen. Coyote comes over and gnaws off a leg, hauls over up behind a bush. Birds of prey come in and start eating on that. And if there weren't any of that, then the microorganisms would destroy that. So when you see a fossil like a fish or a fern or a shrimp, what you see is something that took place in a hurry. And if that didn't convince you, when you think about jellyfish down there in Galveston, how they sometimes die to come to shore, and then sometimes you see fossilized jellyfish. A jellyfish is an animal, it's almost nothing. And yet, it can become a fossil. You have to have rapid catastrophe for fossils to form. And they don't talk about this, they tell you the opposite, and it's just silliness. And then you think about this. A fourth problem of the geologic column is the polystrate fossils. Fossils inside fossils, especially fossil trees. Polystrate trees are more straightforwardly described as fossilized trees standing upright through many rock layers, supposed to be eons of time. Such evidence indicates rapid burial of the tree in mudslides and molten rock layers over a very short period of time. And it destroys the idea that the rock layers represent many millions of years of time. Got a question? Any of y'all ever been given the geologic column in school with trees drawn through it? No, they don't do that. And what they don't tell you, I didn't learn about this till I was out of professional school. Because they don't want you to know about this. And what we now realize is there are polystrate fossilized trees and fossil layers all over the world. And you especially find these in the coal mines. You talk to any coal miner, they'll tell you about them. And Dunbar Rogers says the internal evidence in the strata, however, belies these estimates. In the coal measure of Nova Scotia, for example, the stumps and trunks of many trees are preserved standing upright as they grew, clearly having been buried before they had time to fall or rot away. Here, sediment certainly accumulated the depth of many feet within a few years. Now, you can go to this place in the Kettle Coal Mines near Cookeville, Tennessee, and there's a picture of this 30-foot fossilized tree. The bottom half is in coal, and then the top half is encapsulated in shale. You know, according to most modern theories of coal formation, how coal is formed is you take about 10 or 11 feet of fresh vegetation and you squash it down into about 1 foot of peat. And then you take 7 or 8 feet of peat and you squash and heat that down into about 1 foot of coal. Now you realize How did all this happen? Did the tree just grow through this? Well, that's an impossibility. Did it all take a long period of time for it to happen as the tree's growing? Well, that doesn't make much sense either. No, what you see is evidence of rapid catastrophe, of rapid coal formation. And then the last half of the tree on the top has got shale around that, sedimentary layers. And then there's pictures you can see of these fossilized trees all over the world in these coal mines especially. The evolutionary tree, no, it's science fiction. Do you have any questions about the evolutionary tree? Hey, I got one that nobody talks about. How did animals with exoskeletons? You know what an exoskeleton is? It's when your skeleton's on the outside. Now, we have endoskeletons. You know, horses and cats and dogs, our skeleton's on the inside. But when you're talking about lobsters, their skeleton's on the outside. A crab, their skeleton's on the outside. Could you explain to me the evolutionary process in which you go from animals with an exoskeleton to finally an animal said, you know, I think it'd be better to have it on the inside. You go from a skeleton on the outside to the inside, really? You look at these biologic trees and, man, no explanation. Why not theistic evolution? Because it's scientifically wrong and it's also biblically wrong. The Bible will not allow it. Let's observe why it's biblically wrong. The Bible and evolution are in conflict. In the first place you look is in Genesis chapter 1. And you see the order of creation where God made on day 1 the heavens and the earth, light, day and night. Day 2, the firmament. Day 3, the dry land, the plant life. Day 4, the sun, moon, and the stars. Day 5, the water life and the birds of the air. Day 6, the land animals and man. Evolution gives a different order. So it has the sun before the stars. No, Genesis 1 had the earth on day 1, the stars and the sun on day 4. So when you say the sun and the stars are before the earth, that's just not right. Evolution has the sun before the plants. And the Bible says plants were made on day 3, the sun on day 4. Evolution has the sun as earth's first light. And no, God said the sun was day 4. He made light on day 1. Someone says, well, what was the source of light? Well, that's easy. It's God. And if that's not a good enough answer for you, put it on your heaven list. And when you get to heaven, ask God. My wife asks me questions all the time. I can't answer. I always tell her, put it on your heaven list. Evolution has marine life before land plants. No, land plants were day 3. Marine life was day 5. Has insects before the fish. Well, if those are land insects, I'm thinking that's day 6 and the fish were day 5. Has land animals before the birds. God said, I made the birds on day 5, the reptiles on the land day 6. Evolution has both sexes of man evolving from an ape-like ancestor. God said, no, he made man fully functional before there was a woman. Then he made woman out of a bone from his side. So you see the day-age theory, the progressive creation theory, they don't help evolution at all. The order of creation is just totally different. And so you can say, well, it's theistic, and don't worry about the details. And that may fool some people, but for thinking people and reading people, that doesn't work. So number one, the Bible will not allow theistic evolution because the order of evolution is different than the biblical account. And number two, the Bible will not allow theistic evolution because evolution is all about requiring trillions upon trillions of bad mutations, evolutionary failures, and dead ends to evolve creation. And you notice what he says in Genesis 1, after every step, he said it was good. Day 5, Genesis 1, 21, and it was good. Day 6, Genesis 1, 24 and 5, and it was good. God didn't use macroevolution. God didn't use failure to evolve a creation. Thirdly, the Bible does not allow for vast periods of time to evolve a creation, theistically or atheistically, but 6 literal days. And we just got through talking about how these theories, the gap through progressive creation, day age, and the framework hypothesis, just do not explain away God defining the definition of a day being a day, or an evening and a morning. And someone says, well, do you know those were 24-hour days? Well, you know, in the New Testament, Jesus talked about days being a 24-hour day, essentially. John 11:9 says, Jesus answered, are there not 12 hours in a day? He's talking about daylight. If any man walk in the day, he stumbleth not, because he seeth the light of the world. And we go back to Exodus 20, as we talked about in our previous lesson, we see that God talked about the days of creation, and that word days is the Hebrew word yamin that always means a literal day. So, the question is, what do you want to believe? The truth or a lie? Steve and I were talking about this yesterday. He was showing me some poison. And it was a poison I hadn't seen. Most poisons are blood thinners. They're, you know, rat poisons, rodent poisons. He has this neurotoxic poison. I thought that was pretty interesting. I'm going to look more into that. But when you look at these poisons, when you look at a rat poison, do you realize that basically 99.995% of it's good? It's just food for a rat. Yeah, but that's the trick. A very small percentage, just 0.05%, is the poison. It's the blood thinner. It's what causes the rat to bleed internally. And that makes him thirsty. He leaves your home looking for water. And so that's what just a teeny lie will do. Well, I don't mind lying to a rat. I want to get rid of them. Tricking them, so to speak, not really a lie. And you ask, what difference does it make if one believes or teaches these theories? It's just a matter of how much poison you're willing to take, how much poison you're willing to give your kids. The impact of evolution on society is huge. Back in the 1960s, Time magazine came out, and this is the cover of Time magazine with this article, Is God Dead? Talking about there was a trend in the 1960s for theologians to write God out of theology. We're going to be talking more about this tomorrow. But all the way back in the 1960s, people were talking about how God was not relevant. You see, there's always been two worldviews, that God created everything, and He's put us with certain principles like love, joy, and peace to live, or we came here for by survival of the fittest. And that might makes right. Might doesn't make right. And you see that in schools, don't you? Where people take advantage of those who can't defend themselves. One of my pet peeves. Happens all the time. But Darwin said, well, that's the way the world got better. Darwin said, a man who has no assured and ever-present belief in the existence of a personal God or a future existence of retribution and reward can have for his rule of life, as far as I can see, only to follow his impulses and instincts, which are the strongest or which seem to him to be the best ones. Darwin said, if it feels good, do it. That's the way he lived his life. Well, a number of years ago, there was this guy named Jeffrey Dahmer who kidnapped 17 young men. Did all sorts of heinous crimes with him. And then he was on television with Stone Phillips interviewing him, and Stone asked him, why'd you do these things? I watched that, and my mouth was just hanging open. And then I called my friend, Rick, over in Albuquerque, preached over in Albuquerque. I said, would you put your VCR in and record this and then send it to me? Because, you know, they're an hour difference from us. And I wanted to get this. And here's what it said. Jeffrey Dahmer said, one of the main reasons why I continued to do the things I did for so long was because I felt I didn't have to be accountable to anybody. I just felt you lived, you died, and that was it. There's no lasting consequences. If a person doesn't think there's a God to be accountable to, then what is the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges? That's how I thought anyway. I always believed the theory of evolution as truth. They all just come from the slime, and when we died, that was it. There was nothing. And then he goes on to say how he became to believe in Jesus. And I'm not going to argue one way or another whether he was saved or not. But he's telling us the reason he did such heinous acts, from his point of view, looked like it would feel good. How terrible. So the bottom line is this. Evolution elevates man. And all these problems we see in society, like abortion, pornography, homosexuality, lawlessness, what's the foundation? Really, the foundation's evolution. Barbara Reynolds wrote in the newspaper, "Your kids go ape in school. Here is why." In most schools, John Etta and Johnny are being taught evolution, that humankind evolved from apes. So if you teach your kids they evolved from an earthworm or from an ape, why would we be surprised if they act like apes and act like animals and do things they shouldn't? Again, I showed you this earlier, how these textbooks teach us we came from earthworms. Now, here's the deal. 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik, the first satellite, man-made satellite, to go up into space. And you know what happened? That was about the 100-year anniversary of Darwin's Origin of Species. And our government saw that. They saw this atheistic country over here ahead of us in technology. So your government and mine made a decision. We've got to get ahead of the Russians. And the way we're going to do that is we're going to start doing like they do, and we're going to really emphasize evolution. In the 50s and the very early 60s, the typical textbook that would address this only had about 2,000 to 3,000 words on evolution. By 1963, they averaged over 33,000 words on this. Because we're trying to get better than the Soviets. So how did this huge indoctrination with evolution affect our societies since 1963? Well, teen STDs are up big. Teen premarital sex is up big. Teen unwed pregnancies are up big. Unmarried couples cohabiting, up. Now, they've always done it, but not to the level it's being done today. Teen suicide is up. Violent crime offenses are up. Hadn't helped us spiritually. It hadn't helped us academically. Here's something you may or may not know. We're trying to help academically, so we're teaching evolution in the schools. So you know what happened? SAT scores started going down. In other words, the tests you got to take to get into college, people started performing more poorly all the time. So it wasn't helping us academically. Now, because we don't like to hurt people's psyche, you know the idea. Y'all probably have it here. Do y'all ever have these soccer teams where they don't keep score? Everybody's a winner, nobody's a loser, everybody gets a trophy. It's all about the snack. Yeah. Well, we want to do that academically as well. So you know what they did? Is they started dumbing down the SAT. The very idea that your kids wouldn't score as much as their parents or grandparents did back in the day on the SAT. We can't have that. So let's make the SAT score easier to get the score your parents had. So they dumb it down. You notice the title of this magazine article is dated January 31, 2000. Time magazine writer Barbara Heinrich reviews Randy Thornhill and Craig T. Palmer's book, and the book's called A Natural History of Rape. In this article, it says, "Rape, according to the evolutionary theorists Randy Thornhill and Craig T. Palmer, represents just another seed-spreading technique favored by natural selection. Sure, it's nasty, brutish, short on foreplay, but it gets the job done. Hence, rape is not an act of pathology, but a venerable strategy for procreation. What's natural isn't always nice." Thornhill and Palmer's insistence the rapist isn't a psychopath. Not a psychopath. Just an ordinary fellow who's in touch with his inner caveman leads to some dubious prescriptions. They want to institute formal training for boys and how to resist their natural sexual impulses to rape. That's not natural. And yet when we start teaching evolution wholesale like we do in schools, we're teaching people might makes right, and this is natural. Why is this subject so important? Most people in this country believe in God, but they also believe in theistic evolution. So many religious leaders encouraged this compromise, and I saw this at the Smithsonian Institute, where it said many religious leaders and organizations have stated that evolution is the best explanation for the wondrous variety on earth. So that's why you see these articles, like in time, is God dead? No, God's not dead. God's alive, and His book, the Word of God, is just as important and vital today. John chapter 8, verse 32 says, "You shall know the truth, and truth shall make you free." You're not going to be made free from sin by lies. No, it's by the truth. So I'm going to ask you as we close this lesson, we have an invitation to offer. It's not mine, it's Jesus' invitation to become a Christian. Are you ready to dedicate your life to Christ? If you are, this can be the time. There's no reason to do anything but accept His invitation now. Or perhaps you want more information, and if you do, we're ready to give it. We'll be glad to study with you. Whichever way it may be, if you want to accept the invitation of Jesus, why don't you do it now by coming forward as we stand and sing the invitation song.